BitCo is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan MacLeod. Now, I'm in Gauteng's East Rand today to talk to someone very familiar to many people in the ICT industry, and that's Andy Brouwer, the former Chief Technology Officer of Business Connection. Andy has started his own company called Browtech Innovation. One of the things he's working on really caught my eye, a reversible fuel cell. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, Andy.
You're welcome.
So, Andy, before we talk about what you're up to now, and perhaps for the benefit of the few people who don't know you, you were at BCX for the longest time as CTO. What is your career history in the ICT sector?
It's quite interesting, the acronym ICT, the Information, the Communications Technology. I actually started in the communications technology arena with the then Post and Telecommunications Department. I specialized in data comms eventually. And as I qualified, I was offered a very good position with Anglo-American to move into their electronics and computer division,
okay,
which I did. And I was with Anglo-American for 15 years. And that was really the, I can say, the computer background for me.
So was that effectively their IT shop back then?
That was the IT shop then.
Running mainframes.
It was known as Infogold. Yes, it was mainframes. Yeah. It was electronics involved with that. It was time and attendance systems. And as the newer technologies changed, so it was really the, I can say, a groundbreaking area where we had to understand everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was based in Volcom,
okay,
far away from most of the support. And yes, we had to do very interesting things with mainframes. As the PCs came along, all the newer technologies, before the courses were available, they used to throw it on my desk and say, make it work, or give lectures, or talk about it and make things work. So it was really a good groundbreaking area for me because it was comms, it was databases, it was operating systems, it was the initial Unix flavors that came out, the Linux flavors, the old SCOs, the Novells, then the Windows, the OS2s and everything. So it really was a very good, kind of, foundation.
Yes, and a lot of it, as you say, self-taught. I mean, imagine being in Volcom. What was the mainframe technology you were running back then? Was it IBM?
It was IBM mainframes, okay, mainly, with the SNA communication side.
Right.
Interesting acronyms those days: virtual telecommunications access method, and a virtual machine, VMs at those stage, and today it's back again.
Yeah. And this was before the internet.
Exactly.
The SNA protocol, did you say?
Correct.
Okay. I have heard the name, but it's before my time. It was, what was that?
Systems Network Architecture.
Local Area Networking Architecture.
No, that was actually wide area as well.
Okay.
Token Ring and Ethernet came along as things progressed, but initially it was running on 9.6 kilobit links.
Which were probably blazingly fast back then.
Yes, they were. They were. Extremely.
Okay, so Anglo-American, 15 years.
15 years with Anglo-American.
Okay.
And then I was busy consolidating the gold, diamond, and coal divisions for Anglo Gold with the intent to outsource it to IBM. And there was some software that one company we were using, and they couldn't get it to work properly. I asked them for the books. I made this work. And they offered me a good position.
Okay.
So I left Anglo-American and joined them. And this was a company, South African-based company at that stage, but it was actually connected to an international company called Legent.
Okay.
So I worked for Legent, so to speak, and did a lot of work in the banking sectors, petrochemical, just about every, I think alphabetically, I worked just about in every company in South Africa.
When was this, in the 80s?
This was from the 94,
okay.
Actually. Yes, just prior to 94.
Okay.
I joined this company.
And there were huge investments being made by corporate South Africa at the time. I mean, a lot of companies were...
Absolutely.
I mean, they probably had some infrastructure there, but we were moving into the client-server era of computing. There was massive investment happening.
Correct. And the whole PC era was starting to boom at that stage.
Yes.
And Windows was becoming Windows 95, and all these things were happening. Yes, very interesting times.
Getting into an era I can remember now.
Yes, and I actually went through... working for about 17 different companies, a lot of acquisitions, startup acquisition. This carried on for a long time till we sort of settled down eventually, and I ended up as an exec director for one of the Bitvest Group's companies. And I was with them for quite a while. I did one of the first MPLS networks in South Africa. When most of the people were still in denial as to what voice over IP was going to do and all these things.
When Telkom was still trying to ban it. Yeah.
Yes, and we saw these things coming, and they were on the wall. The writing was on the wall for the older things. And then I was approached by Business Connection. But I had been helping them since the mid-90s as well.
Okay.
At APSA with the Nortel rollouts, and every now and again, Comprex then would contact me.
I was going to say, was it Comprex in those days? Was it Rumanitz still running the company?
Correct. Okay. And then eventually they persuaded me to join them, and I joined them, yes, and I ended up as their CTO for quite a few years.
Yeah, 15 years, if I'm not
mistaken. From 2003 till November 2015, you could say.
Okay.
But it was from 2007 that I was the CTO.
Okay. And Business Connection went through massive changes as well. Of course, Comparex bought out or merged with, I forget the details now.
Business Connection.
Well, with QData.
Yes, as well.
Was that prior to your time?
Well, it was prior to me, yes. Okay. It was the Persatel QData mergers that took place, and that sort of culminated into the Comparex then.
Yeah, and then it became PQ Data and then PQ Africa. And
yes, and there's a PQ Vector as well at one stage, which was the Sun portion in that. And
okay.
Very diverse company.
Yes.
Very diverse company.
Yeah, been through quite an interesting history.
Yes.
So Peter Watt was there when you joined.
He was, yes. Peter Watt was the CEO when I joined. And then the Motlopane brothers with the Business Connection came on board.
Yes.
And that transformed the company into Business Connection.
Mm. And of course, Telkom tried to buy out Business Connection at one point and failed. Came back years later and eventually was successful. And now, of course, BCX. Newly renamed as part of Telkom.
Yes. I think it's a pity it didn't go through the first time.
Yeah.
I think it was a lack of insight from the industry as to what was happening.
Right. Or from the competition authorities' perspective.
Yes, as well.
Because the competitors were objecting to it quite strenuously, weren't they?
Correct. Mm. But yet, you know, things like NTT acquiring one of the big companies, that just set the precedence, you know. And that is a global thing. So I think the mindset at that stage was that we're competing in South Africa where it should have been. We need to compete globally.
Okay. So what was your main role at BCX? What was your day-to-day job there?
Sort of a jack of all trades and a master of most. really trying to help a lot of companies with roadmaps. sometimes I got involved with deep diving problems that had to be solved. Sort of month-end reports that took more than a week to run, you know, things like that I had to sort of help them sign out. Really working on cloud strategies, getting the stuff in the right direction, convincing the company which direction things are going to happen, which is a challenge because one's always making your money out of your core business. And fortunately, Kodak was a good reference for me that, you know, you can stick to your core business while you're making money, but make sure that you have another core to move to and have a sort of a divergent strategy. So, yes, it was really focused on trying to keep the ship afloat and keeping the sales going in the right direction.
Okay. And after you left Business Connection, you had a brief stint at Huawei in a similar sort of role?
Yes, I was also helping Huawei as well. A very nice company to work for.
Yeah.
I think if one looks at the growth globally, the work ethic that they've got, the drive into the industry, the innovation that's actually taking place, it's phenomenal. Mm. Phenomenal company.
Certainly one of the biggest in the world in a very short space of time.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, Andy, you've now struck out on your own, working for a big chunk of your life for large corporate entities. You are now running a startup enterprise, and you are developing what, from what I can tell, at least at first glance, looks like very interesting tech. Now, you've developed, or you're in the process of developing, a reversible fuel cell. Now, I have no idea what that means. Maybe a good starting point would be to get right down to brass tacks and explain to me, if you don't mind, what a fuel cell is, first of all.
All right. I think the easiest way to explain a fuel cell, it's like a battery, but a battery has to be charged and then it discharges. A fuel cell also got a positive and negative anode, a cathode, but what happens in this case, it uses a fuel and this has the chemical reaction of what a battery would have. So as long as you're providing the fuel cell with a fuel, it operates and it doesn't run down like a battery. So the advantage of that is, of course, you can keep energy going all the time.
Right.
Being reversible is now the interesting bit. Most fuel cells use hydrogen, they can use methane gases and that, but ultimately they convert that into a hydrogen.
Is there a particular gas or particular fuel that is better suited to these things?
So ultimately ends up as hydrogen. And the reason for that is the way that hydrogen operates and the catalytic approach that some of the materials have. Also, hydrogen is a very interesting, very small sort of atom.
Right.
It's got a single proton and a single electron, no neutrons. So when you want to make use of this through a fuel cell, you strip off the proton and you eject the electron, and the electron is where the current goes.
Okay.
And that's typically the beginning of how the fuel cell works. Ultimately, what happens is with the once you've cleaned up the gases, which is the hydrogen, ultimately it joins up with an oxygen from the other side, and your byproduct is water.
Okay.
Now, being reversible, if we feed water in one direction, we get the two gases coming out
right
in the opposite direction. So it's not a perpetual motion action, but it is a continuous reactive mechanism that one can sort of get to get it flowing. So it means in one direction it's a fuel cell, in the other direction it's an electrolyzer creating gases.
Okay. What's the advantage of that?
Well, the advantage is that you typically, if you do look at the industry itself, they've spoken about the hydrogen economy for quite some time. And a lot of companies have pumped a lot of money into hydrogen. And some of our biggest petrochemicals in South Africa produce copious amounts of hydrogen. So the issue here is that we're really facing, from a hydrogen economy perspective, they are trying to compare that to operating the same as the petrol, gasoline type thing. So you want to have refineries and you want to pump this all over the country, and that, and that model makes it sort of uneconomical. If you do have the right electrolyzer at home, and you've got water at home, you could produce your own electricity at home. And where this thinking really came from was looking at the dynamics of how the internet has evolved. It's really become a total meshed ecosystem. Sort of what the galaxy looks like when you look at the stars at night, the same sort of methodology. Then you look at how the social networks have evolved, also into this meshed grid. And then you can clearly see that the new technologies like a blockchain is also going into this meshed mechanism. The early bits of the Napsters with the music also evolved into that model. And now we can see that energy is also moving in this direction. Now, this is not to compete with the grid, but if you really look at some of the dynamics, a central point of failure can bring down a country. And that's what that's where the thinking is.
Okay.
How do we go off-grid and have sustainable energy? And then what spurred it even further was, in Africa, there's a shortage of electricity. With the shortage of electricity, you cannot grow an economy. You don't have water because you need to pump the water, and you don't have food. So energy to me was one of the core things that I needed to solve. And then Same if you look at the mobile world in Africa. It's taken off because it's almost off-grid. Mm. Energy has to be off-grid in Africa as well, if it's to survive and actually mean something and get somewhere and generate income, create jobs, and that's
where it's gone. Your original thinking around this, if I'm not mistaken, was when you were working at Business Connection, looking at the energy requirements of the data centers that the company was building.
That is correct.
And building a data center in Africa is not like building a data center in North America. It's got its own unique set of challenges, especially around the supply of reliable power.
Absolutely, yes. If you look at a lot of the countries, that some of them are running on diesel generators permanently. Some of them have serious power outages, and that's a norm. Now, for a data center, that doesn't work. Mm. So for me, the foundation of wanting to move into Africa for a data center perspective means you need to have off-grid energy as well.
Yeah.
And diesel is not always the best economical way of doing this. Diesel gets stolen on the way there. Even when it's there, it gets stolen. Mm. And then, of course, the diesel generators cost quite a bit of money to maintain. Sometimes the generators get removed. But yes, foundation, first energy, and then good communications, and then one can build the data centers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I know that the technology you're working on here is proprietary and you can't reveal everything to do with it because there are other people out there who would love to know some of this information as well. But can you give us, as much as you can, some insight into how you see this technology that you've built? Well, firstly, how this technology that you've built is actually going to work in practice, you think? And then what you see as being some of the applications of it.
Okay. I have a demo outside for you. So I'll take you there just now to show you.
Unfortunately,
exactly
it's an audio podcast. So
what that's going, yes. So that's for your benefit. But for other people interested, they're welcome to contact you and we can make a plan. So if one looks at the home,
yeah,
there's a blackout. Your fridges run down. You want to keep the fridges going. Sometimes there's people that are ill. It's clinics. It's hospitals. It's emergency services. Haiti, as an example, you know, when they had those terrible disasters happening there, and the power is down, having these units available can help humanity. So that's one of the areas, helping humanity. But at the same time, looking at some of the dynamics of the global things that are happening, we know that there's been serious power outages in Canada and in rest parts of the world because of the sun pulses that happen. If that takes out the grid in South Africa totally, that's going to be devastating. I mean, it's not long and then the water doesn't work. And then if water doesn't work, we can't get the food. The supermarkets start running empty. That'll be chaos and riots. So I see this as a clean way of solving that problem before it arises. We can sit here and be boiling frogs. And as the water gets hotter and hotter, we will not realize that it's getting hotter around us. So really what I'm trying to do here is not compete with anybody in the world. I'm trying to face a problem and address a problem. It really comes down to three things for me. It's water, energy, and food. Mm. The rest of the stuff can take place, but without those things, civilization tends to go in a downward spiral.
So the tech that you're building here, how are you going to bring it to market? Is it something ordinary consumer is going to be able to buy? Is that your vision down the line? And how much R&D is required to build this? Is this going to be like a modular box that you can buy and then the idea that you mesh them together in some way? Or
yes, so if you want to, let's take a typical home. It's more or less the size of a Speed Queen washing machine.
Okay.
And that will roughly give you about 10 kilowatts of electricity.
Which is enough to do what?
Well, if you look at the average home in South Africa, and we talk about peak values that they use, consumption, it's about 13.5 kilowatts.
Okay.
But that means that your wife is blow-drying the hair, you've got the kettle on, and mom's busy making some food in the microwave, and dad's busy with a welder outside, something like that.
Right.
And that's what leads to the peak. With a slight bit of discipline, not running the kettle, hairdryer, and microwave at the same time, you can reduce that to 10 kilowatts.
Okay.
Or lower. You can even get that down to 5, depending on the discipline. So it becomes sort of a lifestyle thing, and sort of just changing the habits a bit, and you can reduce the energy consumption. I think people should just do that in any case if they want to lower the cost and save electricity. But typically this is to produce 10 kilowatts, which fits into a nice model for a home. It's a nice model for emergency clinic. It's a nice model for communications environment. It's a nice model for emergency services. So 10 kilowatt to me is the sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
There would be lower units, but you can scale this up into megawatts if you wanted to.
So I put this unit in my kitchen. What is it actually doing?
So you're feeding that with rainwater,
right,
which you're cleaning because the water must be clean.
Okay. So you need a special filter or something?
You need a filter, and there's very good graphene-type filters that we're experimenting with. It really cleans the water, takes out the bad stuff. So it ends up almost like distilled water.
Okay.
And this water would go into a unit which would split the water into two gases for you, oxygen and hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
The hydrogen would get stored in a tank, and there people get concerned because hydrogen being very small, as soon as you put that in a metal container, being small, it works its way into the metal and causes embrittlement.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's different materials. Again, I just mentioned graphene. If you do the proper structuring with microvessels and graphene, you end up with a safe way of storing hydrogen. The hydrogen then gets used in the fuel cell.
Mm-hmm.
So the one side, it sucks in the hydrogen. Other side, it sucks in oxygen from the air, and that produces your electricity.
Okay.
So as long as you've got the flow of hydrogen coming in, you've got electricity at home. Of course, you sometimes use more, sometimes you use less, but there's always a slight trickle going at home.
And is there an output from all of this, water, or at the end of
the day? The byproduct is water.
Water.
Yes.
And then you can recirculate that water?
Absolutely, that water gets recirculated again.
Okay. Is there any loss of water during the process?
Yes, there's a bit of loss of water, but if we maybe, let's say we... because it's going in a closed loop,
yeah.
You lose roughly about 10% of the water in a year.
Okay. And to produce the hydrogen, how much electricity are you using to do that? I mean, this machine is creating electricity, but how much power is actually needed to go through this process?
So therein lies a problem, I think, also with the hydrogen economy,
uh-huh.
is that... We know it's roughly used 10 kilowatts of normal electricity to create 1 liter of hydrogen.
Yeah.
And therein is the problem from the economics perspective. But the deeper you dive into chemistry, the more you realize that there's some very interesting things which people are overlooking.
Okay.
The first thing that they overlook is heat. As soon as you start playing with heat, you are influencing the temperature of water. You know, when you boil water, you get steam. And steam is a little bit easier to separate the molecules than what it is out of water.
Okay.
Then there's some different types of materials that one can use. Experimentally in the labs right now is actually hydrogen production with no electricity. And that's where this has to go.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do not want to consume more electricity.
To make electricity.
To make it, yes. Otherwise the economics doesn't work.
Mm.
But ultimately, yes, what we're doing over here is we're reducing the cost of the amount of energy required to produce the hydrogen.
Right. Okay.
There's a few trade secrets in there which...
Which you can't talk about.
Yes.
But, what sort of ratio are we talking about in terms of the amount of energy needed versus the amount of energy created?
So the single fuel cell that we've got at the moment produces 0.9 volts.
Okay.
If you stack that up about 30 centimeters high in the way that we stack the fuel cells together, you end up with a 1 kilowatt unit, which is 30 centimeters high and 12 mm-hmm. centimeters wide. That's 1 kilowatt.
That's its consumption.
That is the output that it can provide.
And how much
okay.
now, when power we talk, does it need?
When we talk about it needs gas, it doesn't need power, it needs gas.
Okay.
But how much power do we need to create the gas?
Right.
That's the question you're asking.
Yes.
Okay. So typically to split water... In normal environment, is 1.3 volts roughly. That's what you need just to split the water on its own. If you start playing with temperature, you start playing with some odd things as a trade secret, which I mentioned, you bring this down to 0.6 volts.
Okay.
Per molecule that you're trying to split. So that brings down the ratio of to 0.6 to 9.
Okay.
6 to 9. So you can see that the ratio is right. But this is not perpetual motion. You're creating a gas and you're using a gas. Why does perpetual motion not work? It's because as soon as you put a load on it, it stops. That's where perpetual motion dies. In this case here, we're not playing with perpetual motion, but we are playing with some of the rules of thermodynamics, but we're also playing with some of the quantum effects on chemical reactions at atomic level. And this is where most of the breakthroughs come in, not only with what I'm busy with, but the nanotechnologies on a global basis, by positioning different types of chemicals and getting the artificial intelligence to tell you how to put these mixtures together. Therein lies, I think, the secrets that a lot of people have been looking for.
Okay. Now, Andy, you're working with a team of people to do this. Who are some of the brains you've got involved here?
I was very fortunate to get involved. And this is what I was busy doing and what I was trying to achieve, and trying to get hold of some of the materials and things and that. Fortunately, I ended up with two brilliant professors that are known for what their advances have been in this industry, in the fuel cell business. Well, not the fuel cell business, but fuel cell research.
Mm-hmm.
So it's two professors in Paris.
Oh, yeah.
It's another two professors in Genoa. It's another two professors in Bulgaria. And then there's various professors, some at Cambridge and some in Poland, some in Germany, and all specialists in the area. And we now seem to be like-minded on what we're trying to achieve. So it's sort of a mixture now of business, busy building the business models. And I do have an investor that's very interested at the moment. So that's the ecosystem. I've got the scientists, I've got the business side.
How did you get involved with all these academics, the professors you've mentioned?
It was a query that I had with a laboratory in Paris.
Okay.
And I tried to make direct contact with them because I saw what they were busy doing. And they were skeptical as to, who is this guy trying to get hold of them to do what and the rest. And anyway, they sent a lady from Bulgaria that had a property in Umhlanga to contact me, and would I meet her in Sandton? And that is actually where the contact started.
Okay.
So I met with her. She was not involved, but she knew the main professor in Paris and in Genoa.
Okay.
It's quite interesting. The one guy from Bulgaria is 91 years old. He was involved with the Soyuz and Gemini spacecraft,
wow,
which used fuel cells.
Wow.
Extremely bright at his age,
yeah,
and wise. So that's on the one spectrum. We've got a lot of years of experience. And yes, you can talk to him about some things. You'll say, that'll never work. Yes, we should try this. And then there's some younger guys. But all of them are PhD doctors, yeah, professors.
So are they? I mean, do you bounce your ideas off them? Are they actively involved in the process? Do you have a discussion group where you?
They are actively involved. We've actually, mm-hmm, we call ourselves a consortium now.
Okay.
And it is a formed consortium now that we are working on this.
Okay.
And that was formed before we started looking for investors.
Okay. So they'll be shareholders in this new business, whatever it emerges.
Absolutely.
From
okay. So the way that we want to do this is to put it into what I would call intellectual property company.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where we would hold the patents and we would give the investor a share into the intellectual property company. And then we have what I call the holding company. Holding company is responsible for rolling out the business globally, the management of that, the finances of that, controlling the money, looking at the different market regulation and all these things, keeping control of the company. And that would be the holding company. And then below that, a lot of franchises.
So where are you in the process at the moment? You said you've got an investor. Is that a committed investor? That money's guaranteed now? Do you need to go through a further process of raising venture capital? How are you going to?
Okay, so the investor has capital available. That's been made available. They're keen to invest. What we are busy doing now, we're just going through the business plan.
Okay.
But so far, we've been able to tick all the boxes. What is nice about this investor is that they've got inherent interest in the end product. When most investors are interested in the money, it makes it very difficult to achieve the objectives. But when the objective is the end goal of what you're trying to achieve, I think an investor like that on board is quite encouraging.
You obviously can't name the investor. Is it a South African company?
It is a South African company, yes.
Okay. All right. So you're talking about 18 months before this comes to market, roughly?
Yes, I would say that the first ones that we roll into the market was probably about 18 months.
And who's going to buy them first? Will it be industrial applications or?
I have a few companies which I maybe don't want to elaborate too much, but that actually have a requirement right now.
Okay.
And that is the investor itself that has the requirement to roll this out.
Right.
And that's what makes it, I think, very appetizing and encouraging for everybody.
So you've got an investor and a client in one.
Absolutely.
Lined up.
Absolutely.
Okay, interesting. As an ordinary consumer, when do you think that what you're working on here might be available to install in my kitchen and make electricity?
I'll make a plan for you. I think we're also looking, depending on the size of the unit, of course we want to do the trials in the industry first to make sure that we tick all the safety boxes and the compliance and all that.
You've got prototypes now, do you?
Yes, we have various types of prototypes. We have a massive big prototype in Bulgaria where we can prove that the fuel cell is reversible. And we can take you to the laboratory and you can see that goes the oxygen in and the hydrogen in and there's the energy coming out and then we reverse it and you can see the water and the rest. So that is that. The second phase now is putting multiple of these stacks together.
Mm-hmm.
We should be doing that just even prior to the investor coming on board. We call it a short stack. That happens on the 25th of July. This month.
The next week.
Yes. And that we'll be doing in Genoa.
Okay.
In Italy.
I should have asked you earlier, Andy, is anyone else doing this, a reversible fuel cell? It's not a concept I know and it's not an industry I follow very closely, but is there anyone else pursuing the same dream?
At the moment, I think it is becoming a hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
What is good on our side is that we've been scratching in this area now, one can say, for 4 years.
Right. So you've got a head start, potentially.
We've got a head start, and then in the theory behind it, because that's where it all starts, it's 7 years or more that this has been in the making. I think it'll become a hot topic because we need sustainable, off-grid, affordable energy. And you can see, I don't know if you were aware of the yacht that sailed out of Paris, which is going to do a six-year trip around the world. With its own power, self-powered. It's also using solar and wind, fuel cells and the rest.
Mm.
And this is the same model. So hypothetically speaking, you're talking about the unit for your house. What I would like to do for you in your house is that you park your car in the garage. You can top it up with hydrogen if you want to. You can keep your car running because your car produces electricity. And you can pump that, plug that into your distribution box at home, and the extra electricity you need, you could power off your car.
Right.
So now, and the car can run in the garage because the byproduct is water.
Yes.
So you can produce hydrogen at home, you can fill the car up. You're sort of self-contained now all of a sudden, and that changes the business model. This probably gets him in trouble with industry, but that is, I think, ultimately what one wants to do. Change the business model, change the dynamics of how this works, and yes, we'll add hydroponics and things into that and clean water as well over time. But typically that's where we would like to go with that. So it's for possibly outlying areas where people have got no electricity.
And I'd imagine solar will play a big role in this. I mean,
yes, solar will play, but I think solar itself is also going through massive transformation. The current solar panels are not that efficient.
Okay.
They give you nice figures, but then they don't tell you that these figures actually work between 11 and 2 o'clock with the sun shining on top of it.
Right, in the middle of summer.
So either you want to track it, but there's also...
That's more expensive.
Yes. Mm. But there's also other companies which are playing with the idea of photosynthesis, which they call a photocatalytic effect. very much like a leaf takes out the oxygen and uses that and releases the hydrogen, the leaf can do that. So they call it an artificial leaf, and they're achieving the pretty good results. And they're mixing interesting materials like molybdenum and that into that to simulate what that is happening. There's other companies experimenting with paint. Three layers of paint on your roof and you can produce hydrogen. So it's coming.
Lots of different ideas. Is Elon Musk looking at this stuff at all? I mean, obviously he's seen as the picture child, if you like, of clean energy and the energy revolution through Tesla. But is he looking at any of the stuff that you specifically are looking at here?
No, I think we have two different approaches, yeah?
Okay.
Elon categorically has stated that he does not believe in the hydrogen economy.
Okay.
And he doesn't believe in fuel cells.
Okay.
I can again, in turn, say, and I'm not half as popular as he is, and I wish I was as successful as he is, but I don't believe in lithium.
Right.
Lithium's a good battery, but there's other materials which will challenge lithium seriously in the very near future.
Right.
Right. And I'm aware of them, and I've seen them.
Right, right. Okay, and all is his entire focus on his batteries all lithium ion based.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. So you clearly believe Elon's wrong.
Well, I don't think he's wrong, but I don't agree with his
on the hydrogen stuff specifically.
On the hydrogen stuff, I don't agree with him. I understand why he's saying that.
Yeah.
Because if you're using 50 kilowatts of energy to produce 1 liter, I agree with him.
That doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. Mm. But if you're not using that, you're using different things and you come out at the right economics, yes.
Okay. So, Andy, if anyone's interested in finding out more about what you're up to, particularly on the hydrogen fuel cell side of things, you've got a website where there's some more detail on this. What's that website?
I do have a BrowTech website. And then I
what is
can
that?
Elaborate. I do have a direct link, so if people are interested, I can send them the link.
Yes.
And following on from that, it really goes into a signing of a non-disclosure, and then I can speak.
Then you can speak freely.
And then I can speak freely, yes.
We should have signed an NDA before recording this. But then I suppose I couldn't have posted the podcast, right?
No, I don't think I'm what I'm speaking about here is I think,
sure,
largely general knowledge.
Yep.
What is not the general knowledge is the playing around with the nanotech,
sure,
materials. That's where the secret lies.
Sure, absolutely. Great. So, before I forgot, I actually forgot to mention this product has a name. It's called Rigel.
That's correct.
What does Rigel mean?
Okay, so if you look at the constellation of Orion.
Yeah.
You've got Betelgeuse on top and Rigel at the bottom.
Okay.
It's a very bright star. It's not the brightest star, but it mainly functions because of the hydrogen flowing in it. And that's why the group has chosen the name Rigel.
Okay. Clever name. Clever name. I thought it might have something to do with the Rigel Avenue off-ramp in Pretoria, but clearly not.
No, we'll just boost its marketing capability and launch it over there.
Excellent. Well, we'll include a link in the show notes to your website, Andy, if anyone's interested in finding out some more information. Andy Brower is CEO of BrowTech Innovation. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast today, and all the best with Rigel.
Thank you very much.